Hello and welcome to Turn Me On Dead Man. Tonight's show is an interview show with Roger Clay, guitarist for The Droogs. The Droogs are a band who have always been ahead of their time. They formed in the early 1970s, playing what would later be called Garage Revival, several years before it became fashionable. Also, The Droogs released all of their early singles and their first LP on their own label, Plug and Socket, anticipating the do-it-yourself approach of punk rock by several years. Over the 30-year career, The Droogs have released several excellent albums and singles. They're largely unknown outside of a small loyal following, much of which is in Europe. I asked Roger Clay why they chose the name The Droogs.
We were trying to find something that had a connotation of punk to it, and that seemed to be the thing, you know, and punk actually evolved a few years later into mm-hmm. the thing that, you know, most people associate with what came out of England with the Sex Pistols and whatnot, but there is kind of a garage punk mm-hmm. that existed as well, which was what we were shooting for back in 73, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's been sort of a bane of our existence, the name. You know, we're stuck with it now.
Oh, really? Why don't you like it now?
I always thought it, you know, it never really served us that well, but... like I say, we're stuck with it, and I don't really want to change it now after all these years. You know, we definitely laid claim to it. There are a few, and when you do go on the internet and search it, you'll always find some, you know, band from Wisconsin or somewhere that's currently using it.
Actually, I like the name. When I was a teenager, I read A Clockwork Orange, and, you know, I've always liked the movie. And so I think the name is really, it's got a real ring to it. But what would you rather have been called?
Oh, I don't know. All the good ones have been taken. The Doors, the Trogs, I guess that's kind of where you cross the two and you get Droogs.
Mm-hmm.
There was me, that is Alex, and my three Droogs, that is Pete, Georgie and Dim. And we sat in the Corova milk bar trying to make up our Razoo Dogs what to do with the evening. The Corova milk bar sold Milk Plus. Milk Plus Velocet or Synthamesque or Drencrum, which is what we were drinking. This would sharpen you up and make you ready for a bit of the old ultra-violence.
Thank you. change. But the change is gonna come.
Fell into this general category of 60s influenced music that was big for a time and then sort of faded away. I mean, as far as a fashion.
Yeah.
And so you guys have been true to it where other bands either dissolved or moved on to something else.
I think our last release, Atomic Garage, pretty much seals that notion, because all the music's pretty, you know, true to that, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, by design, we made sure we we kept it down to the essence of, you know, what we thought 60s rock or, you know.
What do you think it was about the 60s?
Oh, I don't, geez. There's a dissertation there, huh? I don't know. It's just, so much stuff happened, you know. I mean, it's like, I don't know, the end of the innocence for one thing, but I mean, at the same time, there was a lot of innocence, so it kind of, there's that whole feeling, I think, that, you know, that we could actually change things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just blues and, you know, blues growing into rock and roll, and then kind of becoming more defined, I guess, with bands like writing their own material as opposed to pulling from some, you know, Brill Building list of, you know,
right,
from some A&R guy or whatever. That was, I guess, it was maybe that the whole do-it-yourself notion, maybe, that made it what it was for the 60s, and then as it evolved into the 70s, it seemed to get, you know, bands started disappearing up their own assholes. Progressive stuff. Hey, I know, let's do a whole album. You know, let's do a theme album. I don't know. It just got a little bit much.
A little bit much, yeah.
Game.
Clayton. Gee.
Why'd you pick that one as opposed to, like, Psycho or...
What is our first single?
Yeah.
We could play it. That was one vote in it. In its favor, you know. I don't know. Just, you know, it's real basic riff. I always like the kind of staccato, you know, staccato chord changes that it had. It was kind of like if you could play it like the Sonics did, you know, you're doing pretty good, because it had that sort of like magic in the grooves thing that, you know, just, I don't know.
Well, you kept that around. I mean, you put a live version on Stone Cold World.
Yeah, it certainly became, you know, synonymous with us, that's for sure, and, you know, became our calling card, having done that back in 74 as an independent 45, kind of made it something that our later fans were, you know, definitely wanted to hear us play. I guess we're halfway good at it.
My Love on You.
Once again, that's that kind of tough little chick sort of vocal line that Rick's really fond of, and you know, we just wanted something that really kind of propelled itself, and that certainly song does that. Just one of our basic riff rock tunes.
Okay. Does he have good relationships with women?
Not that you mention it. No. Well, we just felt that was a theme in a lot of 60s music.
It really is. That's like one of the defining themes of garage rock. And Rick's got the sneer, too.
Yeah.
That sort of vocal approach. Then. Yeah.
Yeah, I might be oversimplifying the approach, but... It's definitely somewhere in that ballpark.
Okay. And you held on to that one. That's one that you re-recorded for your first LP?
Yeah, it's when we hooked up with Dave Provost, our bass player. He was kind of instrumental in getting us, settled with the rhythm section, because prior to working with him, our rhythm section had always been kind of unstable and not very supportive. And he was able to take that particular song and smooth out some of the quirkiness in it and make it really strong. So it was worth doing over.
Baby, baby, I'm a one-eyed jack, just a stranger in town. I've been known as a two-headed snake, just laying it down. I've been called worse than devil's son by those who know. Never meant to hurt no one, but that's the way it goes. That's the way it goes. We'll be right back.
Gonna wait till it's dark. Gonna go for a walk. Gonna find where you are. Gonna walk down your street. Gonna find where you sleep. Gonna enter your dreams through the shadows they lead. Gonna wander inside till I finally find your wings of desire. Then we'll go for a ride. Then we'll go for a ride.
Model there. I mean, we talked a little bit about how you just got this idea to make 45s and try to get airplay. But what were you using as a model there? I mean, were you trying to? Did you know of other groups that were doing the same thing? Or
I would say pretty much just what we heard on the radio and seen on television.
No, but I mean, like, just as an approach to try to get airplay, making and releasing your own 45s on your own label.
A model of, gee, I don't know if there really was one.
Because that seems, I don't know what the music scene was like at that time. This would be like 1973, 74, 75.
Right.
But that doesn't seem like it was a very common practice then. I associate that more with the do-it-yourself mentality of the punk movement a few years later.
Yeah, that's kind of what we have been given credit for.
Yet another way that you were a few years ahead of your time.
Yeah, I mean, part of that credit definitely goes to our manager at the time, Mark Schiffer, who is a rock writer.
How did you meet him?
Well, in the graphics business, he was doing his own fanzine at the time. And him and Greg Shaw were buddies.
Oh, the guy from SST? Or
Do the Bomb, I think.
Oh, right, okay. All right.
Yeah, it was Shipper's idea to, you know, do covers, basically. So he kind of had a hand in that choice of Light Bulb Blues. And the Sonics, we were hip too, so that was one we wanted to do. And actually, we wanted our own material on there. But once again, that was his idea to press the records. And living in Los Angeles, we had access to a pressing plant just down the street, Alco. I can remember our project got bumped for a few days because they had to churn out a bunch of Rolling Stone 45s.
Oh, really?
I think it was Tumbling Dice or something. But anyway, all the lathes were busy churning out, you know, the Stones product. So
did you argue with him about releasing the next 45 as two of your own originals?
Yeah.
Or was that the one that was split between, let's see.
Now we had Set My Love on You, and I guess it was I'm Not Like Everybody Else.
So you had the cover on the B-side.
We got the cover on the B-side. It was actually kind of a sort of the parting of the ways with Mark. We set up it became our record label at that point, Plug and Socket. And that was the bone of contention, as they say. But it was just basically a way to get, you know, a calling card. We were trying to, I don't know if radio airplay was really so much in the cards as just to get it out to people that could help us. You know, I know that Murray Krugman was interested at one point. He went with Blue Oyster Cult as opposed to messing around with us, and the Chrysalis Records was looking at us at a time, and they signed the Babies instead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was all in that period when we were pressing up 45s and trying to get noticed. So yeah, I give the credit to Mark for the marketing approach, certainly, but our records found their way on certainly a little record store shelves that, you know, alongside other groups years later, you know, that whole indie do-it-yourself
right
that you were talking about.
Right. No, that it is amazing. I mean, I was just pondering that. I was thinking that I was wondering if you had sort of taken the idea from someone else who was trying it, because it just seems pretty creative, really. I mean, to come up with that sort of do-it-yourself approach at a time when the music industry seems to be going in the other way, that it was focusing more and more on the big blockbuster groups.
Yeah, we definitely went against the grain on that. Certainly our choice of material was also not, you know, what was in the norm or chosen by, you know, the powers that be, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing's wrong, girl, you're feeling so tough. Just one girl for me and that ain't enough. Ha! I gotta love them all, babe, not just a few. Gotta love them all, girl, that's what I got to do. Oh yeah, talk about girls. Just walking by, turns me on when
another one looking so fine. I won't be happy till I make her mine. I gotta love them all, not just a few. I gotta love them all, baby, that's what I got to do. Oh yeah, talk about girls.
When you picked up a guitar?
I started when I was 11, and but of course I'm a slow learner. But I was like about 15 when I guess when I saw Janis, and soon after that, you know, I saw Hendrix and Zeppelin play, and Savoy Brown, people like that, and I just got into the whole blues blues-based rock out of, you know, playing three-chord, you know, garage rock, and all of a sudden it was like, oh, hey, I see the connection, you know, it's a blues pattern, basically, and always had that kind of background to our music as well. Sometimes it's more overt than in other songs, but definitely a thread that runs through it all.
So when did you start playing together then?
Let's see. I would say, must have been about, we had a group called Savage Rose, and that was 66. And we played it.
You must have been really young at the time.
Yeah. I was young. I'm not that young anymore, but yeah, anytime you start talking about the 60s, you pretty much, you know, date yourself, but I always looked young is what it was. And yeah, but we didn't get the grooves together till, you know, early 70s, and that was a thing that we, you know, even though we were recording stuff, writing songs and putting out 45s, we didn't really get to play until the 80s. So while we were sort of a 70s band, or born in the 70s or whatever, we didn't really get out there until the 80s. You know, it was 84 for a U.S. tour, and a small U.S. tour, East Coast, and then 87 for that large one we did with Trower, you know.
I won't take all that they hand me down, and make out a smile, though I will frown. And I'm not gonna take it all lying down, 'cause once I get started, I go to town. Everybody else, I'm not like everybody else. I'm not like everybody else. I'm not like everybody else. And I don't wanna roll around like everybody else. And I don't wanna live my life like everybody else. And I will say that I'm fine like everybody else, 'cause I'm not like everybody else. I'm not like everybody else. But darling, you know that I love you true. Do any sin that you want me to. Confess all my sins like you want me to. There's one thing that I will say to you. I'm not like everybody else. 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 And I don't wanna run around like everybody else. And I don't wanna live my life like everybody else. And I won't say that I'm confined like everybody else. 'Cause I'm not like everybody else. I'm not like everybody else. 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 If you all want me to settle down, slow up and stop all my running around. Do everything like you want me to. There's one thing that I will say to you. I'm not like everybody else. 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 And I don't want to run around like everybody else. And I don't want to live my life. Yeah.
Did you, I mean, when you recorded that, did you realize that these were going to become these garage site classics? Or were you just picking things that you happened to like? I mean, were you aware that they were achieving the status of being cult favorites? Not really. I mean, not at that time. Certainly not in the early 70s. I don't think anyone would have thought they would have become the, you know, classics that they are. I mean, we just liked them as tunes and, you know, for the type of thing they represented, it kind of, you know, not certainly not overly produced, and they really have strong hooks, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's for sure. They're really riff-driven. Well, that's the kind of music that I always like, and that's the sort of stuff that we write.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they definitely fit our kind of template for the music we like to play. How'd you feel when, like, The Last came around and other garage revival bands, and it became something of a movement? Did you feel like you've already been doing that for a while, or were you happy to have more places to play because there was this sort of scene developing in Hudson?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Happy that it came along because we had pretty much just been isolated by our recordings at that time. And there were a few clubs to play, but, you know, with groups like The Last and Unclaimed and coming out, you know, the club seemed to be opening up for that. And I guess it was when we found out that a group called the Psychotic Pineapple, I don't know if you've ever heard of them.
I've heard the name, but I've never heard any of their music.
Yeah, they were out of Berkeley, and they covered Ahead of Our Time, Ahead of My Time, rather. And they came to Los Angeles and played a club, and we went out to see them. And it has a fair version of our song.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of talked to the guys afterwards. And
is there a recording of that anywhere?
Yeah, they actually put out a 45. It's probably about as rare as some of ours.
Oh, I'd love to get a hold of that. So the guys from the Dream Syndicate were pretty closely involved with you then.
Yeah, well, they liked our bass player. That's for sure, because they...
He left the Dream Syndicate to join the Drugs.
Well, you know, he never really left us. He was in the Droogs, and, you know, but we played infrequently, so basically they needed him to tour with U2, because Kendra was, you know, bowing out, and plus they had a record deal, so they needed someone capable, and Dave's a really great musician.
Uh-huh.
He played, you know, with the Textones and Dwight Twilley, a lot of people, so he was more than up to the task, and we didn't mind, you know, because it was kind of basically a tour in our view, you know. And so, yeah, he didn't really leave them as much as he kind of left us and came back. It was more how it went.
I see.
But it was a good relationship, because afterwards Carl Perkota became pretty close to us, in the sense that he used to come to our rehearsals and, you know, give us ideas, and he actually played.
Yeah, I noticed that he played on Want Something.
Yeah, he played on a recording. He also did a show at the Whiskey with us, which was kind of bombastic, you know, and one at the Palomino in North Hollywood. Actually, some videotape exists of that particular performance. So, yeah, he was really cool. And then Steve had that song Maria that mm-hmm. we liked a lot. And he eventually, when we recorded that tune, kind of traded vocals with Rick on that. So that was cool.